All right, so we're diving deep today into a pretty fascinating legal case, Bridgeport Music v. 11C Music. Now, when you first mentioned this case, I have to admit I kind of pictured, your typical copyright dispute, maybe involving a couple of songs, a few artists, but you mentioned that this was a pretty massive case. So what makes this one stand out?
This case is truly massive. It involves a lawsuit that was aimed at over 770 defendants, and all of these defendants were in the hip-hop industry.
Whoa, okay, 770 defendants, that's a huge number. What was at the heart of all these alleged infringements?
Well, the core issue was the unauthorized sampling of the plaintiff's music. And we're not talking about just a handful of instances here. The complaint actually laid out a staggering 486 counts of alleged infringement.
486 counts. Wow. So you would think with a case this big, the court would want to, I don't know, just knock it all out at once, right? Streamline the process. But that's not quite what happened, is it?
No, you're right. It didn't quite go that way. Instead, the court kind of hit the reset button on this whole thing.
They hit the reset button. So what happened? Why did the court decide to do that?
Well, it all boils down to a specific rule, you see. Rule 20A of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure.
Okay, for those of us who don't spend all day reading legal texts, what exactly does Rule 20A say?
Well, in essence, it governs who can be sued together in a single lawsuit. This is what's legally known as joinder.
Joinder, got it. So what does this all mean for our listeners, those who might not be lawyers or law students? Why is this important?
Well, I think this deep dive into Bridgeport Music offers some pretty important insights into how the legal system handles these massive cases, cases that involve a huge number of different parties. You see, it illustrates the limits of trying to group everyone together, even if there's a common thread like copyright law that kind of links them all.
That's a great point. So our mission today is to really unpack why the court decided that this initial attempt to join all these defendants, all 770 of them, was improper. And I think it's important for us to explore what the broader implications of this decision are, especially in areas like copyright law and the music industry.
Absolutely. And to understand this better, we need to start by asking what the plaintiffs were hoping to achieve with this incredibly large, consolidated lawsuit.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, what was their strategy here?
Well, it seems like they were aiming for efficiency, thinking that a single legal action would be, I guess, less expensive and might have a bigger impact than if they had to pursue hundreds of individual lawsuits.
That makes sense. I mean, from a purely practical standpoint. But as we know, the court didn't see it that way. So let's dig into the specifics of why the court made this decision.
Yeah, let's get into the weeds a little.
Exactly. So from what I understand, the court's reasoning really boils down to the requirements of this Rule 20A, right?
Yes, you're absolutely right. And there are two key conditions that really need to be met for multiple parties to be properly joined, brought together in a lawsuit.
Okay, two conditions. What are they?
The first one is whether the claims against all those defendants actually arise from the same, transaction or occurrence, or maybe series of transactions or occurrences that are somehow related. And the second condition is whether there is a common question of law or fact that is shared by all of them.
Okay, so the claims need to stem from the same root cause, and there needs to be a shared legal or factual question. Makes sense.
Yeah, you got it. And in Bridgeport Music, the court really zeroed in on that first condition, the same transaction or occurrence idea.
So they really focused on that. What did they say about it?
Well, I basically said that each instance of the alleged sampling, every single song that was supposedly sampled without permission, was its own distinct event.
Okay, so each individual song is its own separate issue.
Exactly. Just because you might have multiple defendants all engaging in similar conduct, in this case, unauthorized sampling, doesn't magically transform all those individual instances into a single overarching transaction or occurrence. At least not according to how Rule 20A defines it.
So in the court's eyes, just because they were all accused of the same type of wrongdoing, it didn't create this legal mega event that encompassed everyone.
Precisely. And the court actually used a very interesting analogy to illustrate this point.
Oh, I love a good analogy. What was it?
They said, imagine trying to sue 100 different people all in one lawsuit for committing separate burglaries.
Okay, I'm following.
Just because they all stole televisions, it doesn't mean it's appropriate to lump them all together under Rule 20A.
I see. So even though the underlying issue is the same, theft in the analogy and copyright infringement in our case, the individual acts themselves are completely independent.
You got it. There's no shared connection linking those burglaries together. And the same logic applies to the sampling cases.
Interesting. So what about that second part of Rule 20A, you know, the common question of law or fact? I imagine there were some shared questions in all of this.
You're absolutely right. The court did acknowledge that there were indeed common legal questions. For example, did the plaintiffs actually have valid copyrights to the music that was supposedly sampled? You know, was there even anything to infringe on in the first place? And then what are the actual legal boundaries of copyright infringement when it comes to sampling? These are all valid and common legal questions.
But if there were common legal questions, why wasn't that enough to satisfy the rule?
Well, because the rule requires both a common question and that the claims must arise from the same transaction or occurrence. The existence of those shared legal questions alone isn't enough. The plaintiff's case really stumbled on that essential transactional link.
So even though there were these broader legal themes connecting all of the cases, because each alleged instance of sampling involved different songs, different artists, and potentially different licensing agreements or circumstances surrounding the creation of that sampled material, they couldn't all be bundled together.
You nailed it. Each alleged act of infringement would need its own specific facts examined. Like which specific parts of the music were actually sampled, how much of it was used, what was the creative context of the new work that was using the sample. Trying to manage all of that in one single lawsuit with over 770 defendants would have been completely unmanageable.
Yeah, I can imagine. That's a lot to keep track of.
Right. You almost have to think of it like this. Even though the overarching issue is copyright, each sampling instance is its own event with its own unique details, like who sampled what and when and where and how. They're individual stories, not just chapters in the same book.
So the court decided not to proceed with this massive lawsuit. What did they do instead?
The court essentially ordered a do-over. They severed that original case into a multitude of separate, smaller lawsuits.
Oh, wow. So they broke it up into lots of little cases? How many?
They ordered it to be broken up into 476 separate cases. Each of these cases corresponded to one of those copyright infringement counts. And then the plaintiffs were required to file new complaints for each of these new individual lawsuits.
Wow, 476 new lawsuits. That must have been an administrative nightmare.
Oh, absolutely. And it really highlights why the court was so firm in its decision. You see, beyond just the strict legal requirements, there were significant practical considerations at play. Like, can you imagine trying to gather evidence from all those defendants when each one might have their own unique set of facts and legal defenses? It would be incredibly chaotic and expensive for everyone. And then trying to bring such a massive case to trial would be almost inconceivable.
In the documents, there was mention of prejudice risks and the unmanageability of a trial. What were they referring to?
Sure, I can explain. So the risk of prejudice to the defendants was a big concern. You see, if they were all grouped together in one giant lawsuit where the accusations against one defendant might be completely unrelated to the accusations against another, that could easily confuse a jury. The jury might accidentally use evidence meant for one defendant to judge another defendant. This could lead to some really unfair judgments. Imagine a defendant who only sampled like a tiny, almost unrecognizable snippet of a song could be unfairly judged based on evidence that's presented against someone who copied like entire sections of the plaintiff's music. Yeah. It just wouldn't be right.
That makes sense. What about the unmanageability of the trial?
Well, imagine a trial where they have to present evidence and legal arguments for 486 separate instances of alleged infringement. It would take forever, and it would be super confusing and almost impossible for the jury to process all of that information effectively and make fair decisions. It would be a logistical mess.
So it sounds like the court was playing a crucial role in making sure that the legal process was fair and manageable for everyone. It's not about just throwing a bunch of accusations out there and seeing what sticks. The court really emphasized the need for those specific legal connections between cases for them to be tried together.
You got it. It reinforces the court's authority to prevent something called shotgun litigation. This is where a plaintiff tries to sue a whole bunch of defendants, often with weak connections between their actions, hoping that the size of the lawsuit will scare the defendants into settling, or that it'll just overwhelm them. The Bridgeport Music decision makes it clear that courts are going to scrutinize these kinds of cases carefully. They won't hesitate to separate claims if the requirements of that rule, Rule 20A, aren't met. They'll step in if keeping everything together would be unfair or just too difficult to manage.
This seems like a really important takeaway, especially for something like the music industry, where sampling and questions of copyright can be very, very complex.
Yeah, you are so right. The music industry is key here. Because unlike, say, a product liability case where a lot of people get hurt by the same faulty product, music sampling is all about individual creativity and how licensing works. What might be copyright infringement in one song could be considered fair use in another, and it depends on so many different factors for each song. This ruling really highlights that challenge of balancing the rights of copyright holders with the reality of how music is created today, especially with sampling. It makes you think about whether these massive lawsuits are even fair or practical when it comes to this specific creative field.
Absolutely. So what we've learned is that while the original Bridgecorp Music lawsuit may have been intended to be efficient, at least from the plaintiff's perspective, it ultimately went against the rules that are designed to keep things fair and manageable in our legal system. The court's decision to separate all those cases emphasizes a crucial point. Even if there's a common legal issue connecting everything, like in this case, copyright infringement, the specific facts of each alleged instance matter a lot. Each song and each sampling instance was treated as a separate, unique event.
It really raises a question for us all to consider. In a world where it's so incredibly easy to copy and share creative works, thanks to the digital age, how can our legal systems find the right balance? How can we protect creators' rights while also being practical about how we enforce those rights when we might be dealing with hundreds or even thousands of individual instances of alleged infringement? The Bridgeport Music case gives us a real-world example of where the courts are drawing the line, at least for now.
So much to think about. Our listeners, here's something to ponder. Could the plaintiffs have gone about this whole thing differently from the very beginning to avoid having their case split up like this? What other legal strategies could they have used in this kind of large-scale situation to achieve both efficiency for themselves and ensure fairness for all the defendants? This deep dive into Bridgeport Music has really been a fascinating look into how legal theory plays out in real life. It's this complex dance between ideas and their practical application, and that dance keeps evolving as technology and creative practices change around us.